You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. As you may have just heard in our newscast, a fifth man has accused Seattle Mayor Ed Murray of sexual abuse. That man is Murray's younger cousin. Joseph Dyer says Murray abused him repeatedly 40 years ago when the two shared a bedroom at Dyer's family's home on Long Island in New York. Seattle Times reporters Jim Bruner and Lewis Cam broke this story just about an hour ago. Jim Bruner, Lewis Cam, thank you for coming on with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Lewis, how did you hear about this?
Well, about 2 weeks ago, Lincoln Beauregard, the Seattle attorney who represents Delvon Heckard, who was the man who sued Ed Murray back in April for sexual abuse, shared with me a signed statement or declaration from a man claiming to be the cousin of Ed Murray, who was now also coming forward to accuse Mr. Murray of abuse. Now, so Jim and I basically looked at this declaration, and then from there we started looking to whether or not we could confirm if this in fact was the case, that this was his cousin and that Ed Murray lived in New York back in the mid-70s when he said this abuse occurred. And we've spent the last couple of weeks doing that and resulting in the story today.
What does Joseph Dyer, Ed Murray's cousin, say happened?
So Mr. Murray's cousin, his first cousin, is Joseph Dyer's mother, Mary Ellen Sotiel. In late 1974, Ann Murray, Murray's mother, died, and his cousins out in New York had the Murray siblings, one by one, come back and live with them. And Ed went to live with Mary Ellen Sotiel and her family. Joseph was 13 years old at the time. He says he shared a bedroom with Ed during the year or so that Mr. Murray lived there. And he said that during this time he was sexually abused for, about a year while Mr. Murray lived at the home in his early 20s. And he also worked at a nearby orphanage or a group home for troubled children that was run by the Diocese of Brooklyn at the time, called the Little Flower Group Home. And Dyer said, he felt dirty. He didn't want to do this with Ed, but he was told this was his secret. And the abuse didn't stop, according to Dyer and his mother, until Murray was accused of abuse by a boy at the orphanage. And the family, I guess an uncle, supposedly negotiated some sort of agreement where Ed would leave that job. And shortly after that, Mr. Murray left living with Dyer and his family, and he says he's never seen Murray again.
Okay, this accusation that there was also an abuse at this group home, this orphanage in New York, I haven't heard that before, right? Is that a new allegation as well?
Yeah, we hadn't heard this before Joseph Dyer and his mother told us. We haven't been able to find any specific records that confirm it, but the orphanage or the group home did confirm that Ed Murray did work there during that time period. Ed Murray himself, when he spoke with him this morning, said yes, he did work there during that time period. He says that he left in good standing and that he didn't do anything wrong there.
Yeah, before we go any further with allegations, what is Mayor Ed Murray saying about this new allegation that you've just printed an hour or so ago?
Well, we spoke with him on the phone, and he said, yes, I lived in New York during that time period. Yes, I shared a home with my cousin. But he said, no, absolutely, I did not sexually abuse any of the children there. And he said that there's essentially a family feud between the Murray and the Sotiel side of the family that somehow explains all of this. So he denies it, as he has denied the previous allegations.
Yes, the quote in your story is, you attribute to Ed Murray, is, there's been numerous fights between our two families for many years and much ugliness. I guess they see me down and out and they want to finish me off.
Yeah, and basically he attributed this to a family feud, saying it that's rooted in a relationship between his sister and a brother of Dyer's mother, who apparently had a common law marriage that angered some of the family. And that's what Mayor Murray insists this must be rooted in, and he denies all the allegations.
Well, what corroboration did you need before you decided to print Ed Murray's cousin's accusation of sexual abuse?
Well, we spoke at length with Mr. Dyer, of course. We spoke at length with his mother. Both of their stories are very similar. They say many other relatives know about these allegations going back decades. So these aren't new allegations by any stretch, they say. We did contact another cousin just to confirm that, in fact, other family members knew about it. And this cousin lives on the West Coast and isn't in direct living proximity to these folks or anything like that. We also, pulled out some of the foster records that we got in July from the state of Oregon when we received some records from the foster file when Ed Murray was a foster parent in Portland in the early 80s. And part of the narrative in that record indicates, that the timing of all of this seems to fit, that Ed didn't indeed tell a social worker back in the 80s that he had lived in New York with and had worked at the Diocese of Brooklyn with children. So the timing of it appears to fit as well. Now, Mr. Dyer has also gone beyond just giving his word. He's signed a statement, a declaration saying he's willing to testify to his allegations in court or into any sort of, proceedings that might arise from this.
I'm talking with Seattle Times reporters Jim Bruner and Lewis Kam, who have broken this story that a fifth man has accused Seattle Mayor Ed Murray of sexual abuse, and that man is Ed Murray's younger cousin. Again, Mayor Murray denies this allegation, denied it to the Seattle Times, has denied all of the allegations. Jim and Lewis, four other men have made accusations along these lines, and the story has been Mayor denies allegations. How does this fifth accusation change the story in your estimate?
Well, I mean, obviously this is, a family member, which was pretty shocking. I mean, we had no idea this was going to come forward, until it did. And the mayor said his first reaction to us was, no, I'm not resigning, but we're hearing that there may be discussions of that, and it's just only natural to think that this is, possibly going to push him toward maybe having to think about resigning, and or, the city council and others who have held back for now at maybe reconsidering their position. Again, we don't know that for sure at this moment, but I think that's something that everybody is going to be asking now.
Yes. Do you have any reaction on the record from either Mayor Murray's defenders or detractors?
We just broke the story. We're working on that. SeattleTimes.com throughout the day, we'll have every update that we can bring to you.
There. By the way, I see that there's a reaction from mayoral candidate Carrie Moon just landed in our inbox. Just says that Carrie Moon will make a public statement in support of sexual abuse victims and respond to the latest allegations.
Yeah, Carrie Moon, one of the two mayoral candidates, had previously, I think, called for Ed Murray to resign. Her opponent, Jenny Durkin, who's running, has held off on that. So we'll see what happens now.
Yeah, there's a mayoral debate this evening, right?
And this may come up.
I think this may come up. You said that you've heard there may be conversations about Ed Murray's continuing to stay in office. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I'm still doing reporting, so I don't want to get too deeply into it. And if I had something that was firm and on the record, I'd report it. But I think everybody, inside and outside City Hall is asking this question now, at least. But, on the record, the mayor said earlier today he had no intention to resign.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens with that. We're still following it.
Okay, just a couple more questions. For one thing, I know that it is touchy and questionable to ask about an accuser's past, but Mayor Murray has said that his other accusers lacked credibility, partly because they were convicted felons. There was extensive drug use there. Do you know anything besides their supposed family feud? Do you know anything about Joseph Dyer that Murray has or you think is likely to draw attention to?
Well, you know, when we interviewed him, we asked that very question. He said he hasn't so much as taken any drugs during his life. He's never used drugs. He says he doesn't have any sort of criminal record. We tried our best to ascertain that. I could, checking various court records, doing background searches, using, you know, databases as we have at our disposal, we weren't able to find any sort of serious record. You know, he did say, look, I'm a person. Everybody's got stuff in their life they're not happy about. He's had a contentious split with an ex-wife, and he's talked about, not being a perfect person. But as far as we could tell, you know, he doesn't have any sort of serious criminal record and is not a drug user. And from what I understand also is, you know, looking at the court records we were able to find, all we could really find was kind of traffic infractions and that sort of thing.
Okay, I know you're reporting this story. Then final question, Jim Bruner, Lewis Camp from the Seattle Times. What are the main questions you are now trying to answer?
Well, I think first and foremost, we are looking at the mayor's political future. You know, we're seeing whether he really thinks he can weather this, whether the people of Seattle and the other leaders in Seattle would finally say, you know, maybe this is just too much and he's not really tenable as mayor. Some people already called for that. We also will look into, you know, if there is anything to this family feud that would lean toward the mayor's side. You know, I'm sure we'll explore that too.
Okay. Lewis Camp, Jim Bruner, Seattle Times, with the news that just broke this morning. And we appreciate you coming on live and talking about this. And we'll talk again, I hope. Thank you both.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Again, the news is that a younger cousin of Seattle Mayor Ed Murray has become the fifth man to accuse the mayor of sexual abuse, saying that Murray molested him as a teenager in the 1970s. Mayor Murray has again and repeatedly denied this allegation and that he sexually abused anyone. He's already announced he is not running for re-election and has said that he will leave politics when his term expires at the year's end. And we'll keep following the repercussions of that story. You've been listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. More to come. Hope you can stay tuned. It's KUOW Seattle. The Record is the program on Twitter at KUOW right now. I'm Bill Radke. Imagine walking into a clothing store with no actual clothing. A personal stylist is there to help you decide on clothes, but there are not racks of shirts and dresses and pants to dig through. That is Nordstrom's vision for the future of at least one retail store and maybe the future of retail. Let's talk about it. Nordstrom has opened this new store called Nordstrom Local in West Hollywood to test out this no clothing store concept. And here to tell you about it, we have retail reporter Coral Garnick with the Puget Sound Business Journal. Hi, Coral.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You walk into this new Nordstrom store in LA and there's a stylist and what else?
So basically, the stylist will have pulled clothing or boots or, you know, jackets, whatever the person wants, to have them, they'll pull it from the Nordstrom full-line stores. And
so you've already contacted the store.
Yeah, you've contacted or you've expressed interest. Uh-huh. They'll pull these items for you, and you can go in there and try them on, see what works, what doesn't work. You can then order them online if there's some things that you'd like. You can also sit there and have a glass of wine or drink a beer while this whole event's going on. You can also get a manicure if you're so inclined.
Uh-huh.
You can also with the Nordstrom app now, you can do the reserve online, try on in store, and some of those other features. You can do that at the Nordstrom Local as well.
Can you reserve clothes that they bring in, but you haven't bought them yet?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then if you have purchased clothing, you can have them altered or tailored here and then have a manicure or drink a glass of wine while you're waiting.
Okay. Ordering stuff online, minimizing retail space, that seems pretty obvious. Is there more going on? Is this a big story on your beat, the retail beat?
Well, for me, it's kind of just one more piece of what Nordstrom's really trying to do, what the whole, you know, department store and retail scene is trying to do right now. Things have been shaken up with online, and they're trying to balance online sales with in-store sales and just really trying to figure out what the customer wants and how they can better, you know, make it work for whoever the customer may be. So this one is clearly a little more well-to-do customer. They don't have all the time in the world to go to the store and just look through everything. They'll have a personal stylist pick out some stuff and they'll just go and grab it or try it on and do it while getting a manicure.
The word experience comes to mind. Isn't that the thing companies want to give you, an experience?
It is. And
tell you a story.
Exactly. I've talked to a lot of analysts about this exact thing, and it's really about making going into these stores an experience, because traffic is declining. It's no secret. Even Starbucks closed Teavana because of this reason. And so even, you know, in Nordstrom, some of their other LA full line stores, they have happy hours or music that they'll bring in to just get people into the store, and then, oh, hey, maybe they'll buy some clothes as well.
The thing is, if you're going for an experience and not just here's the clothes, buy them or don't, you have to pick your vibe, right? So is it a very privileged, I'm shishi experience? Is it, you talked about music, you know, is it social? Is it hipster? What's Nordstrom trying to decide to be?
My understanding is Nordstrom is still very much trying to figure that exact piece of it out. You know, what do they want to be? And right now it's a little bit more that happy hour, kind of nice classical music theme, and just relax and, you know, and enjoy some wine after work.
But classical music in itself is a choice.
That's true. You know? And, you know, maybe they'll try a few different things.
It's not indie rock.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's still just an experiment. All of the department stores are just trying to figure out what's going to work, what's not going to work. And this new Nordstrom local is just another of the things they're going to try to see if it makes a difference.
Speaking of local, why is Nordstrom not experimenting with this in Seattle?
That's a good question. And, you know, I was thinking about it and I was looking at a lot of what different analysts were saying. And it's very, it is more for the upper class person who's going to have this personal stylist and Hollywood. You know, they've got Rodeo Drive. I think they're very used to this kind of thing. But, you know, it could work in Seattle, too. We've got a lot of millennials with a lot of money, so you never know.
Right.
Some analysts have said if it works for Nordstrom, they could picture maybe 100, you know, of these Nordstrom locals around the country. So I'm sure we would have one here.
Do you think Nordstrom eventually would want to phase out its big local department stores?
I've had people ask me that question before, and I've kind of run it by some analysts, and they are known for their big department stores. I mean, that is Nordstrom. That is what they are. And, you know, they haven't had to close like the Macy's and the JCPenney's and the Sears have had to do, but they didn't have nearly as many. They're very strategic about where they put them and why they put them there. And so, you know, I think they've closed 2 in the last handful of years. They're doing that part of it right, and people know their stores and go to them for a reason.
You're a retail industry reporter, Coral. What are the retail industry analysts saying about this? Give them thumbs up, thumbs down?
So far, what I've seen is more of the thumbs up. If they can make it work, if it actually does bring in customers and they like this experience, then they, like I said a minute ago, they could see it really expanding to possibly being about 100 locations.
I'm typing in Nordstrom stock right now. What have you what have you heard?
The Wall Street was not the biggest fan yesterday after the news first came out.
Up a 0.5% today.
It is.
But it dropped like 2 or 3% yesterday.
I think it was down 5 when I checked right before I left yesterday.
Huh. These things are not always related.
Yes. it's always hard to know.
It's hard to know. One more thing about Nordstrom Local is the name. Doesn't it seem like the opposite of local? Your clothes are far away. What is local about Nordstrom
and,
Local?
You know, I haven't gotten to ask them about that yet, but I was also curious. And also, to me, Nordstrom Local, I think Seattle also, because, you know, they're from here. But I haven't heard about that one yet.
We've been talking about Nordstrom's. Has it opened?
It opens next month.
Next month. Yeah. Okay, they haven't opened it. It's next month in West Hollywood, where you go in. It's Nordstrom, but the clothes aren't there. The clothes are somewhere else, and you're trying them on and having a manicure and wine and an experience, listen to classical music. One more question I want to ask you, Coral. Have you heard that Amazon might buy Nordstrom?
I have actually heard this quite a bit.
Yeah.
We actually even wrote that story the day that Amazon announced or that Amazon announced the Whole Foods deal, you know, before it was closed. But when they just first announced it,
we had the idea that Nordstrom is the Whole Foods of clothing.
Yeah,
that could be
the next grab. But from everything, you know, and it makes sense. Nordstrom is a great retailer, and they have a name that's known for, you know, that they're known for. And Amazon is really, they're kind of trying to pluck at, you know, those physical locations. They just got Whole Foods, and they're really into apparel. They have their own lines now. So it could make sense. But where it doesn't is when Nordstrom announced that they were making, you know, thinking about going private, the Nordstrom family was very, they said, you know, they were not going to be giving up their shares. They own more than 30%.
Family controlled.
Yeah, they own a little more than 30%, and they were not going to be giving up their shares in their, you know, possibility of looking at going private. So I don't think it's going to happen, but, you know, Amazon's persuasive. You never know what could happen.
Yes, they are. Coral Garnick is the healthcare and retail reporter for the Puget Sound Business Journal, and she got through this interview without ever saying Nordstrom's. That is how it's done. Are you from here?
I practice a lot trying not to put the S on the end. But no, I'm from Alaska.
From Alaska. Well, good to have you here. Nicely. I know it sounds curmudgeonly of me, but nice job on not making it Nordstrom's.
Thank you.
And thanks for telling us about what Nordstrom is up to. Appreciate it.
No problem.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Monkey selfie coming up. We already have the headline. The monkey pressed the button. Bernard says he's considering it for the title of your what?
That's going to be the title of my memoir, The Monkey Pressed a Button.
Yes, that's on the board. That's Bernard Bellet.
In fact, I'm going to press a button right now.
Please do.
Watch
and then
this.
Come back and listen some more. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke with news that there is a break in the case of the monkey selfie. This is the famous photo of a grinning monkey, a crested macaque that got a hold of a camera and snapped quite a good selfie. Who owns that photo? Legally, only humans can own copyrights, but some animal rights advocates argued in court that the monkey's image belongs to the monkey and no human ought to profit from it. Today's news is there's been a legal settlement in this case. Let's talk about the whole thing with wildlife and travel photographer Michelle Westmoreland. She's based in Redmond. Thanks for coming in, Michelle.
Thank you for having me.
I want to talk about your wildlife photography, of course. First, who is David Slater, this photographer? Do you know David?
I don't know him personally, but I became familiar with the story because as a wildlife photographer, we paid attention to copyright issues and things that come up in the news. And this did strike me quite a bit and to the core because working as a wildlife photographer, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to make a living. It's very challenging to be out in the field and to capture really compelling images that tell a story. And his monkey selfie did just that.
Let's talk about the monkey selfie. This photographer, David Slater, was at a nature reserve in Indonesia. And he says that monkeys had been grabbing his camera for a couple of days. And so he had the idea of mounting the camera on a tripod to see if they would play with it. And he used a very wide-angle lens. You're the photographer, so tell me if this sounds right. Adjusted the settings to predictive autofocus, motor wind, and a flash gun?
Yes, all of those pieces of equipment are available, and I don't know what system he uses. I know my system, and yes, I can set it up using specific lenses and having a flash, having it autofocus.
That stuff matters because he's painting a picture of himself being much more involved than I left my camera someplace and a monkey found it and produced a photograph.
Oh, totally. I mean, I agree. It took a lot of planning and thinking, and he had to know what these animals' responses, and having spent time with them for a few days, he would start, you know, identifying what this particular monkey can do.
Yes.
I found it remarkable.
Apparently he said they were interested in seeing themselves in the reflection of the big glassy lens, and they liked the noise of the shutter, and maybe that's why the monkey was smiling. First of all, was the monkey smiling? Is that even a fair word to attribute to a monkey?
Probably not. We as humans tend to anthropomorphize everything we see in wildlife, especially when it comes to the furry, the cuddly, the cute. I do a lot of marine life photography, so dolphin and dolphin smiles are all, often humanized quite
sure.
a bit.
Yeah, what do you think the dolphin's thinking when you're clicking away?
You know, they're curious about what it is. I've had them in the wild come up to me and look at their reflection in my big dome port of my underwater housing, and they'll kind of squeak and bark and then take off and come back. And so it's just a playtime with each other, and sometimes they get the best of you.
It'd be very different if we thought that monkey was grimacing instead of smiling.
It would be.
Right? What do you think? Well, I'm just curious your take on the photo. I mean, there's actually more than one. There are a few of the monkeys playing around with the camera. There's one that's the most famous. That's the grin or the grimace. What do you think of? You're a photographer. What do you think of that photo?
You know, it's always the one shot, and you know it when you get it. And because we can, on a digital basis, we now see what the results are so quickly. It just really strikes you when you get the image. And I'm sure David Slater went, oh my goodness, that's the story right there. It's a compelling story.
Why is it so compelling?
Well, again, we humanize things. So
why do I want to humanize things? I mean, maybe I want to think that monkeys, that I'm different from a monkey. I mean, a lot of human history is us thinking that we have souls and they don't. And you know what I mean? They animal, we human. But it's like at the same time, we want to think this monkey's one of us.
I think that's what's typical of most people viewing an image. They want to connect with it. And the only way that they generally can connect with it is by personalizing it.
Uh-huh.
So when you personalize it, you're now making it a human reaction, a human interaction. So, having this and having selfies being so popular, what better connection than to have this animal take his own photo and then just happen to have the right kind of grin on his face?
Yes. Do you ever feel like, am I either exploiting this animal or kind of pandering to our desire to humanize an animal?
Well, there's two arguments to that. As a matter of fact, being a fellow with the International League of Conservation Photographers, we have a large group coming up for WildSpeak in November. And the photographers who are fellows and involved with ILCP are going to have just these types of conversations. What is ethical? What are we trying to capture? What are the stories we're trying to tell? And I think for an image to be compelling, there are times we have to have that human connection in order for people to care. For example, would anyone care about this macaque and that it's an endangered or critically endangered species if there wasn't some kind of connection visually with it?
Right. In fact, the settlement, I started with the news that there's a settlement. The photographer has agreed to take a quarter of the money he makes from this photo and donate it to charities that protect the crested macaque's habitat in Indonesia.
And I think that's a great way to arrive at a settlement. I wish this decision and agreement had been done much earlier because there was so much cost to the photographer. And I understand, as a photographer, how expensive it is to run a business and try and go out, especially in wildlife and nature photography. Incredibly expensive and not necessarily profitable. So you have the great expense. And him having to go through this litigation cost him a lot of money, where he is now questioning whether he can continue or not.
Yes, he published the photographs in a book, and some groups used the image without permission and said, well, it's in the public domain because it can't be copyrighted because no human took the photo. Where did you stand? By the way, a federal judge ruled that only humans can own copyrights. Where did you stand on this controversy? Who owns Naruto, is the monk, the name humans have given this macaque. Who owns Naruto's selfie?
As a photographer, and knowing how complicated it was to just acquire that image, to have the wherewithal to plan it, purchase the equipment, fly there, spend days there, I truly believe it was David Slater who owns the copyright. It brings to question, with all the new technology, where are we going to go with this? And where's the photographer and his ability to capture images, whether it's by camera trap? I mean, that's going to be a big question. Infrared, tripping.
Like tripping a laser.
Exactly. Mm. So where are those issues going to come? I still believe it belongs with a photographer because he or she are the ones who put the initiative and the planning in to capture that image to tell the story.
Is it possible to exploit that monkey? Is it possible to exploit an animal when you're profiting from the images?
We have those, and again, it's going to be very interesting because our group, ILCP, is going to have just those discussions of exploitation versus storytelling and what and raising awareness as to a particular species that needs some attention. So is it exploitive for him to have made some money on it? I don't think so. He needs to pay his bills as well. We all do. And it seems to be that imagery today doesn't have the value to people. A lot of the viewers out there don't have an understanding that there is a cost in a business that goes to capture those images, to tell those stories, to get them to care.
Michelle Westmoreland knows about the business. She's a wildlife and a travel photographer based in Redmond. The website is westmorelandimages.com, right?
Right.
And you're having a conference coming up soon where you're talking about issues of ethics in photographing animals?
Yes, correct. It'll be in Washington, D.C., and the function is called Wild Speak, put on by International League of Conservation Photographers.
And I think monkey selfie is going to come up, it sounds
like.
Oh,
you betcha.
Michelle, great to meet you. Thanks for coming in and talking about this.
Thank you.
It's KUOW's The Record. We'll be right back. You know those lyrics? Tutti Frutti, oh Rudy. Not the original lyrics. Did you know that? Little Richard wanted to sing Tutti Frutti, Good Booty. That was too scandalous, so he had to change it. NPR music writer Ann Powers has a new book about the history of sex and music, and her book is titled Good Booty. Good Booty, Love and Sex, Black and White, Body and Soul in American Music. Ann Powers told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel why she wanted to name the book for some lyrics that nobody's ever heard.
I was sitting in my office and, you know, kind of gazing out hopelessly over the task of what can I name my book? And there I saw the biography of Little Richard, and the song just started playing in my head. And because I'd researched the song and knew that the original lyrics were these dirty, greasy lyrics about sex, it immediately started playing in my head. And I thought, good booty. That's perfect.
Clearly, Tutti Frutti wasn't the beginning of sex in popular music. Did you find a beginning point? Is there like a marked beginning point for this?
Well, the beginning point of American popular music being a way for people to express desire, longing, yearning, pleasure is really the beginning of this nation. And that's why I go way, way back and start at the turn of the 19th century in 1807. In the first chapter of Good Booty, I really tried to explore how Africans who had been enslaved preserved their legacies and made a new culture by creating a language of music that felt like a secret. And they, you know, that was right there out in public, but carried secrets inside of it, mm-hmm. even, you know, in the rhythms, not just in the lyrics. And that's really why I think American music became such a conduit for what everyone has trouble talking about, because it was this way that things were carried on.
I've got a song here that I want you to listen to by Josephine Baker. Now, obviously, she did not live in the early 1800s, but she was an African-American artist. She left the country, and she explored some of the stuff that you're talking about, and sometimes it was secretive. It wasn't frank.
All the cold along the mer, là-bas sur le ciel clair, il existe une cité au séjour enchanté.
J'ai deux amours is a part of a a song tradition that I explore in the book, Creole songs that came through the Caribbean and to the southern U.S. via the African Caribbean diaspora. These songs told intimate stories of relationships in antebellum times, often relationships between enslaved people or between enslaved people and their masters or mistresses. You know, the mixture of people, the connections between people, sometimes under oppression, sometimes in violation, sometimes in love, that these songs tell the story of. Mon pays et Paris.
I'm talking with Ann Powers, NPR's music critic. We're talking about her new book, Good Booty, and this subtitle. I want to talk about the subtitle, Love and Sex, Black and White, Body and Soul in American Music. There is a lot to talk about there, but let's start with black and white.
Yeah.
How does race play into this topic that you decided to tackle, sexual themes in American popular music?
Two things. One, I knew that if I was going to write a kind of sweeping history of American music, that I would inevitably be writing about race and racial oppression, the legacies of slavery, the resilience of African American people, because I believe that American music is African American music, and there is no style or genre of American music that's not touched by those legacies. It's not as simple as black and white. It's definitely more than just that binary. But the binary is important because the binary has created so much mythology, so much bad habits of thinking in our society, things we're dealing with now, you know. What I really didn't want was to equate black with primitive or raw or, you know, closer to the libido or any of those bad habits of thinking, those cliches that I think are really a problem and that a lot of music writers have fallen into. What I wanted to do was show the sophistication and the elegance of the way that enslaved Africans created these new forms out of what they brought over and preserved their spirits through music. And then as the centuries wore on, continue to do that in different ways.
I want to talk a little bit about another one of the places and times that you explore in the book. We could spend a lot of time talking about Jimi Hendrix and the life that he lived in Seattle in the 50s and the 40s. But you actually spent a lot of time in your book talking about New York in the 1920s.
Mm.
It shows me you could have chosen many different times and places to focus on in this book, but you chose this place for a reason. New York, 1920s, blues musicians. Why?
New York in the 20s was such an incredibly vibrant, exciting place for music, for theater, for street culture. There was also so much dancing, and I always looked to wherever people were dancing the most. And the embodiment and the epitome of the modern. So women are coming into their own, you know, they're expressing a new sense of their own freedom. Married couples are trying to have a more zingy relationships. Sexology, the kind of like the joy of sex 1920s style was really popular. Couples were reading up on how to be better lovers. They were looking to performers to teach them about that. And the music's just so fun, you know. It's very racy sometimes, just hilarious. Just, I wish I could time travel back there.
Well, I have a piece of music from that time from Bessie Smith that you're going to recognize this as soon as I play this. I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl.
Tired of being lonely. Like the whole world's wrong. Since my man's been gone, I need a little sugar in my bowl. I need a little hot dog.
I feel like I have to point out here, I want a little sugar in my bowl, I want a little hot dog on my roll. There's not a lot of room for innuendo there. It feels like that's fairly easy to interpret.
She was hungry. She needed some lunch.
She wanted to have a dinner party, obviously.
When people say, oh, you know, have we reached the absolute bottom as far as lyrics can go? You know, is Blurred Lines the worst or whatever? You know, I just point them toward the 20s Blues Queens because that was a time of amazing innuendo, amazing dirtiness in blues. Bessie Smith, of course, one of the most popular recording artists of the first years of recording. And there's just an art to it. There was an art to smut at that time that I love. And I think these women voiced it so wonderfully with that big, frank way of singing, you know, that just puts it right out there.
Well, and I love that there's a sort of emotional appeal in the beginning of it.
Yeah.
She wants a man to tell her troubles to.
Yeah, and tell her troubles to and get a little back rub as well.
Okay, Ann Powers, we're going to time travel about 25 years or so, World War II, post-World War II era. You write about the invention of the teenager. That grabbed my attention. It never occurred to me that a teenager was invented, that was an invention. What did you mean by that?
In the U.S., the teenager became the absolute focus of popular culture, of social hope and anxiety. After World War II, so many American men had gone, their lives had been lost, or many came back damaged. There was a lot of fear about the future of the youth of America, and teens got thrust into this strange space of being asked to be more adult than maybe they were ready for, but also because of post-war economic prosperity, also being given more leisure time, more consumer power, encouraged to be young for a longer time. So this is happening at the same time. And the teenager is sort of that weird creature, that weird hybrid creature who is, you know, both grown and a kid. And how that connects to sex, of course, is that teens were being encouraged to date very young sometimes, even by their own parents. You know, I found all these amazing sort of manuals, like for parents or for kids, like how to negotiate being a teenager and dating, and what do you do about your urges? How do you only go to second base or something? You know, one of my favorites advised boys when they felt these strong urges to take up hiking or other vigorous activities. That probably worked a lot here in Seattle. There are a lot of opportunities to hike. But we always think of rock and roll at that time as being the spirit of the teen and the spirit of the liberation of the teen. But what I hear in it is so much anxiety and so much uncertainty about how to behave and how to handle these new responsibilities, including erotic responsibilities.
That's a really nice introduction into the next song that I wanted to play for you, this song, Baby Let's Play House by Elvis. Well, you may go to college, you may go to school. A pink Cadillac, but don't you be nobody's fool. And now, baby, come back, I wanna play house with you. It's interesting to listen to those lyrics about, you know, you may go off on your own, you may go to college, you might be able to accomplish things, maybe even buy yourself a car, but really, I want you to come back and play house with me.
Right.
That really speaks to what you're talking about, that idea of the roles you're supposed to be playing, how you're supposed to be an adult, and that coupling up and having that life as a married couple, playing house, I'm scare quoting that, matters.
So the teenage girl is so important in the 50s. She has a lot of power as a consumer, as a culture maker, as a facilitator of rock and roll. You know, teenage girls, they ran the fan clubs, they got the word out about these stars. Girls who were not much past their teenage years were often working at fan magazines. So rock and roll was really shaped not just by the screams of teenage girls, but by their opinions and their vision. At the same time, what's the goal for a teenage girl in the 50s? It's still to go play house, right? And so that exactly, that very thing, it just, you know, it's a great example of the confusion I'm talking about.
I'd rather see you dead, little girl, than to be with another man. And I'd love it, baby, come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, come. Come back, maybe I won't play out with you.
We've talked a lot about innuendo, about really clever language around sex. We haven't heard anybody say the actual word sex in any of the songs we've listened to yet. I mean, there's, you know, there's an explicitness to lyrics today that I don't think was present then. And I wonder how that influences that dialogue you were talking about.
Well, we're living in a different era as far as accessibility to explicit material. And one reason why you don't hear the dirty words in recordings of the past is because radio is regulated. That's why Little Richard changed the lyrics to Tutti Frutti.
Right. Booty was not allowed.
Yeah. Or they thought it wouldn't be. And now, kids, adults, anyone, you know, they can listen to whatever they want. So I think that's one reason for the rising amount of flat-out obscenity in lyrics. At the same time, I think there's still some good innuendo happening out there. You know, Nicki Minaj gave us Anaconda not too long ago. That art still exists.
Fair enough. But I wanted to talk a little bit more about the connection between technology and the way, you know, what we have access to and what that means for people who are making music. You connect technology with Britney Spears, which I had not expected. So... So how does Britney Spears and this technology that you're talking about, all of this access, what's the connection there?
Well, Britney Spears was one of the first superstars of the age of digital natives. So her fan base is the first generation to grow up with online access, to be using chat rooms. Britney and the boy bands who came up alongside her, like NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, were among the first artists to be marketed via the internet. And also the sound of her music, very much synthesizer oriented and processed. She had that voice that worked perfectly. There, you know, Hit Me Maybe One More Time, you can hear it in the way she shapes her syllables. On later songs like Toxic, it's almost like her voice is a synthesizer. And so I have a little fun talking about Britney as a cyborg.
Yes, I found that really interesting. A cyborg figure. What does that mean exactly?
I mean, she's not really a cyborg as far as I can tell, or a replicant. I'm a big Blade Runner fan. But, you know, the way in which she embodied kind of all-American sweetheart style wholesomeness, but also this perfection that can only be achieved through various forms of enhancement. And those forms of enhancement were more accessible to more people than ever in the 21st century, and alongside the fluid life online that kids have been leading, there's also much more access to plastic surgery, to steroid use, especially for boys, to, you know, just various forms of perfecting yourself in a cyborgian way. And I think Britney was really the star who embodied that shift, which is a very deep shift and which changes our sense of our sexuality along with our sense of our very being. She's the queen of that.
So if Britney is the queen of that, but it's a deep shift, where else do you see that cyborg influence?
Well, I don't know if we're trying to get to Beyonce here.
But we can always get to Beyonce. I'm happy to go to Beyonce. Yeah.
I mean, I go from talking about Britney to talking about Beyonce. And, you know, if you are simply looking for sort of cyborg imagery, the Single Ladies video, you know, she's wearing that glove, which was called the Gling. She's in what filmmakers call an infinity cove with that white background. So it seems like she's sort of in this 2001 A Space Odyssey type space. It's important, though, when we talk about the augmented self or the virtual self, that we also remember at this moment in history, We're painfully aware of how bodies are still being violated, and particularly how African-American people, African-American bodies are still being violated. Black Lives Matter movement was happening all through the time I was writing this book and was so much on my mind. And Black Lives Matter and this new civil rights movement is so grounded in what I'm talking about with technology allowing for us to witness what's happening to people's bodies. So both exist at the same time. And until we, you know, enter that Star Trek age, that Star Trek episode where, you know, we're all we are is a big brain that floats above a table or whatever. Do you remember that episode?
Yes.
That was my favorite episode when I was a kid. But until we enter that space, we are in bodies and we experience everything that Bessie Smith experienced, everything that, you know, Jimi Hendrix experienced, everything that Elvis experienced, and those truths remain central to our lives.
That's Ann Powers, NPR music writer. Her new book is Good Booty, Love and Sex, Black and White, Body and Soul in American Music. She talked with KUOW's Jeannie Yandel. I'm Bill Radke. I wonder if Good Booty is going to come up tomorrow when Beach Boys singer Mike Love comes into our studio. I can't think of anything sexy about the Beach Boys, but there was a rumor that this song, All I Want to Do, may or may not have included the sounds of sex. That's as bad as raunchy is. That's the Beach Boys attempting to be raunchy and raw. Maybe Mike Love will set the record straight. If you have a question for Mike Love, email me at record@kuow.org, or talk to us on Facebook or Twitter, and we'll ask Mike Love about himself and about Brian Wilson and genius and popularity and music and surf and sand tomorrow on KUOW's The Record.